Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only. Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast. Glad you could join me, and we have a terrific episode on tap for you today. We begin with Bobby Marks, my former colleague over at the Vertical, now over at ESPN. Bobby jumps on to talk about everything going on in the NBA today, from the Celtics and how they're playing to Cleveland struggles and the surprising rise of the Detroit Pistons. How sustainable are these first 3-4 week starts of these teams? I get into that more with Bobby Marks. A little bit later on, Quinn Snyder, the head coach of the Utah Jazz, he joins me for a one-on-one. Quinn and I talk about how this team is moving forward after losing Gordon Hayward and how they're going to build up another winner in Utah. So all that and more next on the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
This is the Vertical Podcast, hosted by Chris Mannix. From interviews.
Let's bring in John Wall.
He's Reggie Miller.
Bring in Eric Spoelstra.
To the latest NBA news.
To insights you won't get anywhere else.
Rioting is bad. You shouldn't riot.
Past episodes of the podcast can be downloaded in the iTunes Store and Google Play.
Why wouldn't you go back?
Subscribe and leave a rating or comment. Here he is.
Speaking of guys putting their foot in the road,
Chris Mannix.
Yes.
Joining me on the podcast this week, a familiar voice. A former friend of the podcast who has moved on to bigger and better things, but is rejoining me for a cameo appearance. Bobby Marks is back. ESPN NBA front office insider, former assistant general manager with the Brooklyn Nets. Hi, Bobby.
Hello, Chris. How are you?
I got to get something on my system here first, Bobby. Ready? all right. I got a joke for you. I got a joke. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Boston.
Boston who?
Boston doesn't have that pick you gave him anymore.
I tell you what, though, you know what the positive is that once that since we're not working together, my wife has now took the locks off the windows on the to get to the roof because she knew the Chris Mannix jokes weren't going to be coming. And it's funny though. I like watching that team play though, even though yeah. I was a part of giving them three of those players: Kyrie, Tatum, and Brown. when it's all said and done, we'll talk about it. But I love what they're doing up there. I really do.
Yeah, let's start with them because recording this on Tuesday morning, and as of right now, 12 straight wins. If they beat the Brooklyn Nets on Tuesday night, they'll go into the Warriors game with a 13-2 record, which seemed impossible to imagine just a few weeks ago when Gordon Hayward was lying on the court in Cleveland and done for the season with that broken ankle. Since then, they've just been playing, you know, high-level basketball with everybody. Jason Tatum has played well. Kyrie Irving has played well. I look at Al Horford, and I think this is the best I've seen of Al Horford really since the, I would say probably the 12-13 season when he really started to peak in Atlanta. When you watch Boston, what jumps out to you in terms of how they're able to do this with their all-star swingman down for the season?
Well, when I look at Boston, and this goes for all the teams, I before the season gets going, I write down a couple notes per team, what I want to watch. And for Boston, it was, you know, have a name tag when training camp starts. 10 out of the 14 players were new faces there, trying to integrate a new system. What are we going to get out of that bench? And this is before the Hayward injury. So you were looking at, you know, Rozier, you know, Tatum, Brown, possibly Marcus Smart coming off the bench, Aaron Baines, all new young players. And I'm just stunned that Brad has been able to, with the Gordon Hayward injury, I thought they would still be good and I thought they would be relevant in the East. probably not a top two team, but somewhere in that 3 to 5 range. But what he's been able to do and integrate all these different faces and their identity is defensively. You know, they're number one in the league in defensive efficiency. And with Horford out for a little bit, Kyrie was out for, you know, a little bit. I think he'll want to probably hopefully play in this Brooklyn game or in the future. And then the role of Tatum and Brown to ask what they've been able to do from a first and second year player is really remarkable. And then the rest of the players, they all know their roles, from Rozier coming off the bench, Marcus Smart, Aaron Baines, Daniel Tice. I don't know where Danny found him.
that was an Austin Ainge specialty, actually. Austin was the one that, from what I was told, he was the one that grabbed, found him. But you're right, Tice, I mean, another guy playing over his head. But you mentioned the defense, Bobby, and that's where, I mean, it's not like there's a bunch of A-plus defenders on that team. I mean, before the start of the season, how many Kyrie Irving can't defend jokes were kind of out there? I mean, Jason Tatum is a rookie. I mean, Marcus Smart has a defensive reputation. Jaylen Brown came in with the expectation that he was going to be a better defensive player, but that's one of the most surprising parts of all this, that and the rebounding that's been pretty good.
Well, the surprising part is that, as I said, there's so many new faces, and it's a communication and trust level that, and then when Hayward goes down, to be able to kind of put that out there right now. Usually, you know, in the early part, you went on talent alone, you know, although in Oklahoma City that they're a little bit of a struggle right now. But that's kind of, that is the surprising part, is that to get 10 new faces, and everybody on that team has a role. I mean, every guy from Shane Larkin to your second round picks this past year have somewhere, Marcus Morris coming back, have contributed somewhere around down the road because they've needed to based on these injuries. And I think this group is only going to get stronger. I think, barring injury, the one thing I'd be concerned with Tatum, of course, we always, with all these rookies, is the rookie wall. Mm-hmm. When will that come into place? If, you know, based on 82 games, you know, these players are 35, 40 games in college, so that would be somewhat of a concern there. The Kyrie minutes, I think they've done a great job when he's played, as far as managing his minutes. His minutes are lower than they were in Cleveland, so that would be a concern if they start to creep up a little bit as far as his workload. But Horford. You know, I know he got knocked, and we talked about it last year, you know, max contract, what his role was. But I think with Kyrie, those two guys fit perfectly together.
Yeah, their pick and roll game early, it resembles two guys that have been running that play, pick and pop too, that have been running that play for years and not just a matter of weeks. There's a comfort level between them that's significant. And with Horford too, it's not just his second year in Boston, though that's part of it. I think it's the continued evolution of his perimeter shooting. This is something that he picked up kind of middle of the way through during his run at Atlanta. And this is kind of like the culmination of where he's at as a perimeter shooter. He has never been more comfortable, I think, beyond the 3-point line than he is right now. And you're seeing that. I mean, he's catching kickout passes, and there's no hesitation at all from him out there. And when he's knocking that down, that 3-point shot down as consistently as he can, I mean, the floor is just wide open for a guy. I mean, look, Irving wants to drive. Tatum wants to drive. You know, when Horford's out there dragging the bigs out into the onto the 3-point line, that's a tough team to contain in the half court.
Well, you're right. I mean, when was the last time you saw a big shoot 49% from three?
Yeah.
I mean, and his attempts are right over north of three there, and that's the evolution of the big man as far as how the league has changed, especially with, you know, a league built on wings and, you know, small ball that you see it in L.A., you saw it in Brooklyn last year with Lopez, for these players to have a role down at the end of games. That's something that's, you know, that they're needed to add. And I mean, Horford went from 35-7, he's at 48-7 right now. I mean, that's a huge jump, and I base that all on, you know, a lot of it on Kyrie, certainly.
All right, so the Celtics are rolling right now, and the Cavaliers, their rival right now, I mean, they get a win on Monday night. They beat the Knicks in you know, LeBron v. Cantor or LeBron v. Neil Aquino, which I guess whatever you need to get up in the morning to get your juices flowing there. a little bit. I'm curious to know your level of concern with Cleveland right now, though. I mean, the Cavaliers, they're eventually going to get Isaiah Thomas back, and Isaiah is going to help them offensively, no matter what percentage he is of the guy he was last year. But defensively, Bobby, when I watch this team, they have so many problems defending the point of attack. And that starts with Derrick Rose or Dwayne Wade or whoever is at the point guard position, or as they call their own, it doesn't matter. Whoever's there has real problems defending bread and butter plays like the pick and roll and stopping anybody at the top of the key and off the dribble. And if you can't defend at that spot, if you have these fundamental breakdowns at that spot, I don't know how, I just don't know how, Bobby, you evolve into even a middle of the pack type of defensive team. I mean, when you look at Cleveland and their defensive problems, are they reconcilable? Are they something that's going to get better, do you see, as the season goes on?
Well, I mean, I think in the Knicks game, the second quarter was certainly a layup line for New York. I thought in the fourth quarter, their defense allowed them to get back in the game. But it was funny. I was watching that game and I was about to type that I'm going to break protocol and start sounding the alarms in Cleveland, although we're only 14, 15 games in, because the team is old. The team is boring. The team is vanilla. And when they don't make jump shots, they get run out of the building. And they can't defend. I mean, it's almost like you're almost going to have to put in a zone, because from a one-on-one defenders, they're as poor as I've seen for a team that's been to the finals 3 years in a row. So does the Thompson, Isaiah Thomas injuries, do they get better when that comes? I mean, Isaiah's not a great defender at all. I mean, it depends on how many, where you put Tristan when he comes back, Kevin Love is certainly, he's turned into a stretch four. I mean, we always talk about it. Now he's just sitting in a corner. They have no post-up presence besides probably LeBron there. So if in the East, can you get away with it? You probably can. That's why you never want to bury them, because when you get into the playoffs and it's, all you got to do is win, in a seven-game series and the games are spaced out, then you certainly give them an advantage, like that Washington game a couple weeks ago on that Friday night. But I don't like this team at all. I really don't. And I don't know how they're going to get better unless they want to dangle that Brooklyn pick, which I certainly don't recommend them doing. It's almost like, Chris, they have too many players and too many players that aren't very good. I mean, like, they've got a lot of rotational players, Wade, Shumpert, J.R. Smith, Korver, Calderon doesn't even play. It's like they're built for the regular season because he stretches that rotation, but the guys are old. I mean, they just, it's like where are you going to get a spark from? And I think they got really fortunate in that Knicks game.
Yeah, I think we're in early November or mid-November, and a lot can certainly change over the next 5-6 months. But even without Gordon Hayward, I think they're going to have a lot of problems in the playoffs. They wind up against Boston with the Celtics' athleticism, with their defense right now. I mean, Boston to me looks like a team, Bobby, that you're right about the wall with Tatum, but if he can push through that and if they can manage his minutes properly, I think he can be a factor this year in the playoffs. We know Jaylen Brown can be a factor this year in the playoffs. I think they're going to have big problems if they wind up facing Boston, even without Gordon Hayward, in a playoff series. But I wanted to ask you about Washington right now. And the Wizards, they seem to have some issues of their own down there. I mean,
They seem bored.
Yeah. And they get up for big games, right? Like, when there's a big game, Washington will show up for it. I mean, they might not win it, but they'll show up for it. A run-of-the-mill regular season game, and most of them are, they don't seem, like they have the proper motivation night in, night out. And this is a team, Bobby, that talks a lot. They talk a lot about their place among the Eastern Conference and the Eastern Conference hierarchy. Wall and Beal, their place among the best backcourts in the NBA. Is it concerning that at this point of the season, they do, as you say, they look bored?
It is. The Sacramento game, they got off to a terrible start. They wound up winning by, 18, 19 points on a Monday night. So, did they kind of turn the switch on? Yes. Can you do that all the time? No. But for a team that's gone to never gotten past the second round, It is a little bit of concerning, but the Wall, Beal backcourt, as long as they stay healthy, you know, Porter, Oubre Jr. Has certainly got developed off the bench. I think they've done a better job with Meeks and Tim Frazier, Mike Scott, that group there. But yeah, I mean, it is concerning because they're certainly a playoff team and a top four team, but for them to take that next jump, it's going to be important on seeding. They can't go into the playoffs as a 3 or 4 seed. I think you got to jump up into that top two somewhere. Can they do it? I don't know if they're consistent enough during the season to do so. Can they run off 8 out of 10, 7 in a row? Possibly, but at least through the first through the first month, that is a little bit of concern based on consistency. And you know, it's like they're almost just counting the days to get to mid-April.
Yeah, they're still an extremely dangerous playoff team because of that starting lineup. I mean, you're right. Wall and Beal, you know, they're still high-level guys. I think Otto Porter's going to keep getting better as the season goes forward. Their bench is still a concern, and I think from a coaching perspective, there has to be even more emphasis placed on keeping Wall or Beal on the floor at all times. They've got to really stagger these guys and their minutes. But this is a team that I agree with you on the seeding. Like, they can't just coast through the regular season and wind up, you know, in that 4-5 slot. If they do that, they're going to have a lot of problems.
They are. They will, and you saw it last year, not having a game 7 at home probably certainly hurt them losing up in Boston. And now it comes with they have a high payroll, top 5 in the league. It comes with certain expectations. So from an ownership and certainly from a management, and this roster is locked in for the foreseeable future based on the contracts from this past summer here. So this is what you have, and your bench is basically what you'll be able to work with as far as, you know, in the future next year, and it's limited. So this Washington team is either going to be a good team, regular season team, good playoff team, or can you take that next step? And it's basically going to be on your backcourt to do so. At least from a mental standpoint, because it is such a long year.
All right, so the Knicks lost last night, but I mean, Knicks fans everywhere are looking at a 7-6 start as, you know, I mean, that's like a championship season right now for a team that has been largely irrelevant for the better part of the last two decades. The Knicks are not only playing good basketball, but Porzingis is playing, you know, otherworldly basketball right now. Kind of an early season MVP candidate. Only 20 points against the, and I say only kind of, you know, jokingly, but he's been putting up such monster numbers in the first few weeks of the season that he's really earned his place at 22 as an MVP candidate. When you look at Porzingis specifically and how he's developed this year, how much of this is, hey, Carmelo's gone and it's really his team now? How much of it is the style of play changing with Phil Jackson not kind of dictating from afar? How do you divvy that up with Porzingis?
I think you put an emphasis on his body this summer. I really do. I think he got a lot stronger. I think he really, you know, he can go down low. He can, you know, from a perimeter standpoint, I think another guy that needs to stay healthy. But no Carmelo, no triangle. He is the primary role. He's the primary focus. He knows that he's going to have to do a lot of the heavy lifting there. But I just look at his strength. I mean, his lift, his core strength, his ability to shoot over defenders, his size, and it certainly gives him an advantage there. And you know, it is a good start for New York. They're 7-6, but you have to remember nine of those games have been at home. So what happens now when you go on the road? They've only had 4 road games. So I said it last night with Nitakina that, you know, he was indoor at the end of game, and I think that's the best thing, because you need to put him in crunch time minutes like that and not worry about what the actual result as far as in the standings. But I think Porzingis has fully embraced being that franchise level player that we thought he was when he came, when they, you know, his first year there. And he is certainly only going to get better. I mean, that's a fun team to watch. We killed the Hardaway signing this summer, but you know, I mean, it was an overpay, but you know, shooting is at a premium there. Courtney Lee certainly has embraced his role there. I don't know what the future of Noah will be. That's not a movable contract, and I don't see him in that lineup. So, but just circling back to Porzingis, I think as long as he can stay healthy and avoid some of those bumps and bruises, the elbow, certainly that sidelined, or in the ankle that sidelined him in that Orlando game last year, that this team can stay around that eight seed during the year.
You make a good point about where they're playing their games, like a lot of home games early on, the road games are on tap. But when you look at what's different with this team, I mean, defensively, they're still a bottom third of the NBA team. It's offensively where they've evolved, going from 18th last season in offensive efficiency to inside the top 10, I think eighth overall in efficiency this season. How sustainable do you think that is? You mentioned Hardaway's playing, the way Porzingis is playing. You know, what's realistic for this Knicks team offensively this year?
Well, I think it's sustainable. I think a lot of it has to do with Jarrett Jack. I mean, can he get through a full season? Hadn't been healthy until this upcoming year, and you're relying on him to give you some, you know, not really starter minutes. He's not playing 30 minutes a night, but kind of give you a little bit of a baseline, and then you can put your rookie out there. So I think that has a lot. I think that has a lot to do with it. You know, from a defensive standpoint, how can you get better? They've been good at end of games. That's the one thing they've been able to do as far as being able to finish out games. We've seen that besides the Cleveland game. We saw that with that Indiana game a couple weeks ago at home. But from an offensive standpoint, your primary guys are, and you've gotten a lot out of Kanter so far too. I mean, that's another player there, but what else can you get? Can you get something out of Beasley, your rookie Dotson? Sessions is kind of buried on the bench. You know, it's funny that the one signing that's really hurt them and hasn't been able to contribute is the Ron Baker signing. You know, like you kept four point guards because of Baker's ineffective play, Jack's prior injury history, Sessions, and your rookie there. So I think if you look at that lineup there, their focus coming into the year was to develop their young players, and really it's been Porzingis and Hardaway Jr. so far, and your point guard that you drafted in the lottery. Those are kind of your three focus.
You mean Ron Baker is not living up to the 2-year $9 million contract that they gave him? Is that?
And I don't blame Ron Baker for. I think we all would have signed it.
Oh no! I mean, he should have announced the second he signed that deal that he was picking up the option year for the second year. Like the moment he agreed to it, he said, "I'm taking that. It'll be a full two-year deal, not a 1 year plus one option there."
No, you're right. And that's not. And you can't be. And he's got a 1 year bird restriction, so that cannot be traded without his approval there. So yeah, I mean, it's an interesting contract just based on, and it's a player who's been shuttled back and forth to the G League in Westchester. He played a couple games up there so far. So for a guy that you thought was going to be your backup, is certainly not the case.
Yeah. Well, look, the Knicks and their fan base would be ecstatic with an eight seed this year. I mean, that would represent major progress. I mean, given the culture of that team over the last decade and what they went through the last few years with Phil Jackson. I know that, hey, look, I was one of the people, Bobby, that expected them to kind of mail it in this year, to go, you know, all young and wind up bottoming out. And in the last year before lottery reform kind of kicks in, that they'd be one of those teams that tries to grab that top five pick. But, you know, they're not hugely talented, but Porzingis is such a big time talent, and what they're getting out of Hardaway and others, I think they're more likely than not to be able to sustain this to the point where they can get to, you know, 38, 39 wins, and that'll get you in the playoffs in the Eastern Conference.
It will, and I think you look at the standings, there's a lot of 7-6 teams, 6-7 teams, right around 500. Orlando is, you know, 8-6, before, you know, while we're taping this. And I think that's the first 6 weeks of the season. It gives a lot of teams hope. A lot of teams haven't kind of let go of the rope or thrown in a towel there. That's why playing teams early on, like, you know, like a Brooklyn, even, you know, Orlando, Indiana, teams like that, that we didn't probably expect much of, that those teams still think they have a, you know, chance of, you know, competing for a playoff spot. I think you start to see some separation probably sometime in mid-December there, where, you know, you know, teams that were at 500 have gone on a 5 or 6 game losing streak. So that's where things kind of, get, you know, a little interesting.
All right, since this is now the sustainability podcast and how teams, you know, what teams can keep up this pace, I do want to ask you about Detroit. And, you know, 2 years ago, Bobby, Detroit looked like a team on the rise. They were a 44-win team. They got to the playoffs. They got swept by the Cavaliers in the first round. But a couple of those games, you remember, they kind of threw a scare into Cleveland with how they played. You fast forward to last season, and everything really kind of fell apart, whether it was the way Drummond was playing, Reggie Jackson, you know, just completely devolved to the point where, you know, Detroit was dangling him out there for basically a first-round pick. I mean, that's all it would have taken to extract Reggie Jackson last season. Now, you look at this year, they open the season 10-3. Jackson is playing more consistently. Drummond is back to leading the NBA in rebounding. He's shooting free throws at a mid-60% clip. We'll see how long that's going to hold up for, but when you watch Detroit, I mean, it's largely the same guys as last year. Where are the differences that you see?
The ability to keep Drummond on the floor at the end of games based on his improved free throw shooting. Tobias Harris, all-star level year, professional scorer. You know, he's consistently giving you, you know, 18, 20 a night. The one thing that had kind of gone under the radar was the Langston Galloway signing in the offseason, based on, because we were all focused on Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, and, yep, you know, they signed Galloway, and then it was like, oh, they're hard cap now. How are they going to fit Caldwell-Pope? And I think what Jeff Bauer and Stan Van Gundy did was basically draw a line in the sand and say, this is what we can offer Pope, and, you know, it was $13, $14 million. And, you know, that backcourt with the bench, Ish Smith, Langston Galloway, those two players have played really well. Their plus minus is off the chart when they're in the game. Anthony Tolliver, veteran, he can come in and certainly stretch the floor there. And there's really not much drama. You know, we did hear the Reggie Jackson name, I guess, mentioned in when Bledsoe was on the you know, was being talked about being moved, yeah, a little bit. But it's kind of a team that's really, you know, a team that has a top 3 or 4 record in the NBA is kind of flown under the radar. And it's what we thought they were going to be last year, but it's a year later, which is fine. And I think, and you're able to with Stanley Johnson, you know, he's still only 21. You know, can he be a Michael Kidd-Gilchrist type player there? You know, where you're not asking for a lot of offense, but he can be certainly a good defender. I think that's maybe where the focus is going to be. But they're an interesting team. We haven't talked about them at all. It's been, you know, Cleveland, New York's, you know, development, Philadelphia, of course, Milwaukee. But Detroit's kind of just chug along and done their business.
Yeah, Jackson's a big part of their ability to sustain this. I mean, the playing that position, which is a grind every single night. Now, and he's an odd guy. I mean, I know that when you were in
we
Brooklyn,
we almost traded, yeah, for him. I did my research. Yeah. I liked him. You know, I thought, you know, it's fun. Interesting with Reggie Jackson is we tried getting him in for a visit when he was coming out of BC, and he wouldn't come in. I think he had a guarantee already, so that was already.
Oh, I remember talking to Billy, yeah, about that. Yeah, I think Billy was going to draft him anyway.
I think we would have. They had him in the witness protection. I think Oklahoma City had him in the witness protection program.
Oklahoma City loves doing that. They love hide and seek with these guys.
And then we almost traded for him in I guess January of 2015 with Fort, yep, Brook. So I know Reggie Jackson quite well. It was always about a guy who was always a backup. And can you handle, you know, can you handle starter minutes? Can you, you know, once you, you know, when you move over a seat, it's a big difference. And I think him being out last year to start the season with that injury really set him back. And then you're really talking about kind of a chemistry issue. But it's a guy who's on a pretty decent contract based on where the money had gone there, and I think you do have a little bit of a safety net. I talked about those two guys coming off your bench with Smith and Galloway, where if he struggles, that you can kind of insert one of those players.
Where, as you studied him over the years, you know, what's the downside to him? Like, what do you have to worry about with Reggie Jack? Because I think we saw a lot of the negatives last season. I know in Oklahoma City, he could be really difficult to deal with. He's not the, I mean, mercurial is kind of a good word to describe Reggie Jackson. I mean, what do you have to worry about with him?
I think him forgetting what his role is on the team. I think although it's good for players to think they are better than what they are, that he's got enough scoring around him where he can be the primary playmaker. You know, he doesn't need to be a lead first guard or scoring guard. He doesn't need to be an Eric Bledsoe type guy, although different now in Milwaukee, but that Eric was maybe in Phoenix there, where he's got enough scoring around him. I mean, he does with the focus should be to maybe play through Drummond, or, and you've got, you know, Tobias Harris on the wing there. So you don't need him to go out and give you 25-30. Can he be more of a playmaker there? I think where things kind of go off the rails a little bit is when he is in a scoring mindset, and I don't think they need him to do that.
Yeah. The one thing about Detroit is I maybe they don't play at a 10-3 pace all season long, but I do think there's a measure of sustainability there, that they can be a middle of the Eastern Conference playoff team. And if they are, I mean, that size up front, Jackson's skills at the point, they can be a threat to a lot of teams in that pack there. So,
well, you know what also, Chris, is that we always say, like, oh, it's early in the year season, it's only 4 weeks in and stuff, but for the teams that get off to good start, you know, I mean, we knew Houston and Golden State were going to be good teams, but for even Boston to win games, you probably, at OKC, for Detroit, at Golden State, eventually you're going to go in a little bit of a slump here, where you're going to lose a couple of games. And if you can get some separation, 10-3, 12-2, and you bank some of these games, that down the road, a bad loss on a Tuesday night won't really set you back that maybe it did a couple of years ago.
Yeah, no doubt. Let me finish with this. The panic meter has dipped a little bit in Oklahoma City over the last couple of days. They have back-to-back wins. Paul George goes for, 79 points in wins over the Clippers and then the Mavericks. They've also got some winnable games coming up in the next week with Chicago and New Orleans. New Orleans played better, too, but they're on the schedule. Coming into the season, Bobby, and I know you've talked about this before, but coming into the season, we all kind of said that this Oklahoma City team was going to go through some problems early on. They've got three guys that were in the top 20 in usage rate last year. You incorporate three guys like that, you're going to have some bumps along the way. How, when you watch the Thunder, how is your anticipation, whatever it was, of how they might struggle matched up with how they've struggled early on? And what is your level of concern of this team kind of figuring it out moving forward?
I'm concerned just based on the two teams in front of them, or there's a bunch of teams in front of them, but how well Golden State and Houston has played, especially without Chris Paul. I thought this is kind of where they would be, maybe a couple more wins. I thought maybe they'd be like 8-5, somewhere around there. But that Sacramento loss was a bad loss. I thought you could have just won on talent alone in that game. And I watched this Oklahoma City team, and I just see a lot of guys. It seems like we've used this word on this podcast, sustainable. That they've got there are some really good stretches in the first half that do not carry over into the second half, fourth quarter. They've been terrible on offense. I got a lot of players standing around, a lot of one-on-one, some bad shots. At least in that Sacramento game, in the Denver game. That kind of, you know, sets their offense in shambles a little bit here. They played well without Carmelo the other night, where Paul was kind of be the main focus. So how do you kind of incorporate all three players? You know, Russ at the level he was last year is not going to be the Russ this year, unless he wants to take over games because he's trying to get those other two players involved. The one thing that they've been able to, I guess, hang their hat on a little bit that's kept them in games is they've been one of the top probably five teams defensively. You know, the defensive rating is up there. So, but I had them pegged as probably the second best team in the West ahead of Houston beforehand. Their bench, Felton, Patterson, Abrines, trying to incorporate that group, some new faces there. So, certainly a playoff team, but at this stage, they are more likely getting to the second round, which is, you know, for that type of payroll and where the payroll is going to be next year. that's not good enough. That if I'm the owner, that's not good enough. But you know, where do you go? Because you know, you're not like you're gonna have a lot of cap space to kind of build this back up.
Yeah, I mean they're tied into this in terms of making building up a contending type team. There are a couple things that I look at Oklahoma City that I think they can and if, for their sake, hopefully will get better at. I think Steven Adams. I'd really like to see Steven Adams be more of a presence offensively. He's still averaging the same number of shots, but as you know, when you watch him, it's a lot of putback stuff. It's rolling to the rim. I think there's a better post player there than people give him credit for. But on that team, you don't get a lot of low post touches, and I think establishing him, you know, would benefit that team. The other part of it is Carmelo. You know, he can get hot at times, but he still shoots them out of games. That Boston game, the second half, Carmelo shot them out of that game. He did. Yep. And that's a problem. They've got to figure out, you know, how to stop these kind of cold streaks and how to stop, you know, Carmelo from having these types of outings.
Well, especially if you know, from a perimeter standpoint, you know, these misses turns into, yeah. You know, you get those teams, your opponent running, you know, and with Paul, I mean, the guy's 6'9", 6'10". I mean, you could post him up, maybe you post Carmelo up more, try to get some more easier baskets, because eventually you get some tired legs, especially on the second night of a back-to-back or when you get into a fourth quarter and you're just constantly relying on jump shots. And you'll certainly make your fair share, but when your margin right now for them is so small, when all these games are 3 or 4 point game, I mean, you get in a cold stretch for 3 minutes, you know, you're going to be up three at one point, and then you're going to be down seven. So I think that's kind of where, you know, if you're Billy Donovan, and this certainly is a work in progress, and they've got the benefit of an 82 game schedule, is that how do you try to get some more easier baskets?
I think the other part you have to factor into is, you know, this goes for every team, but that the shortened schedule, the shortened training camp has affected everybody. And it really is.
Yeah. It is. I mean, it. You know, that was this team especially. It's interesting that the games, you know, they're certainly spread out more during the regular season. But I think if you ask a lot of teams, going from 4 weeks to 3 weeks, as they did in September, October, really, really has hurt teams.
Yeah, no doubt. Bobby, always great to talk to you, man. I will return you to Zach and Windhorst and Ian Begley and
well, this was not the Mike and Matt the Mad Dog reunion.
This was not.
It was certainly close enough, and I really enjoyed it. Thanks, Chris.
I will bottle up my pick jokes for, you know, a couple of months, and maybe we can get you back at some point down the line.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks, Chris.
All right, when we come back, my conversation with Jazz coach Quinn Snyder. Support for this podcast, as always, comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They understand that home plays a big role in your life and family. That's why they created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, with Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. It's convenient. Our trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. And in addition to getting a real mortgage approval in minutes, you can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you're getting the right solution for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/Mannix, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS consumeraccess.org number 3030.
Joining me on the podcast this week, Quinn Snyder, the head coach of the Utah Jazz. Quinn, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
So right around this season, you're right around 500 as we're recording this. Mm-hmm. Really good at home, haven't won yet on the road, playing good defense, struggling a little bit on the offensive end. How does that match up with maybe what you expected the first few weeks of the season to look like?
I think it's pretty, I won't say par for course, because I think we played a few really good games early. But the inconsistency on the offensive end, we've really been on two different ends of the spectrum depending on the game, where we've had, you know, on some level, I won't say epic proportions, but we've had some games where we've really struggled to score, and then Like last night, there's times when we've been able to create a little more offense and make some shots. But we anticipated that being the case as far as the inconsistency offensively, as you know, your team evolves and losing your two leading scorers, losing Joe Johnson, who was kind of a guy that we looked at as, you know, really a starter on many levels and a finisher and a guy we could go to late to get a bucket. And then losing Dante Exum early. So your expectations, there's always an optimism at the beginning of the season, and I'm not saying there isn't that now, but it's tempered a little bit. You know, with the personnel changes, Dante was a really good fit for that. He was part of the reason, he and Ricky Rubio, that, you know, we thought we saw our team evolving in a certain way offensively, and that changes a little bit. And then guys getting used to each other. And, you know, the defensive end is where we knew we'd have to be not just good but great. I think to be as competitive as we hoped we'd be in the West. And we've scratched that at times. We've had a couple games where that hasn't been the case. Some of it due to, you know, our breakdowns, and some of it due to James Harden being pretty good. So that's but that's the NBA, and we're grinding away.
You knew coming into the season that you were probably still going to be able to be a high level defensive team, and you were last year, and you are once again this year. But you know, even from this off season to the last couple of weeks, as the injuries have kind of piled up, how much recalibrating of an offensive identity have you done with this team?
Well, we've done it theoretically. You know, when even a shorter training camp and just the repetition and kind of the evolution of an identity takes time. So the personnel changes at the beginning of the year impacted kind of our plan, so to speak, from at least from the coaching staff, that, you know, how we want to play, how we're going to use guys. And then when you lose some key pieces like that, it has a further impact. So I wouldn't say we're searching right now, but we're definitely learning about our group, and I think that'll continue to be the case. You know, defensively, you know, we even schematically we're different, you know, as anyone would be. If you have Rudy in the middle with his rim protection, that impacts what we can do even more on the perimeter. And now with him out, you know, one of the things we wanted to do defensively, Chris, was we felt like the one area last year where we were, you know, average or below average was forcing turnovers. And some of that was because we weren't trying to. You know, we wanted to, the focus was more on discipline and position. And, you know, some of the same personnel changes that would impact our offense, we felt like with the Tabo Cephalosha, with Ricky Rubio, Epke Udo, guys that have length and can make plays defensively, we wanted to force more turnovers. So we've done that. But we're going to undergo another kind of evolution right now, even on the defensive end as well.
When I talk to you know, coaches of teams that play you guys, one thing that comes up frequently is you offensively, you really make teams work late in the shot clock. And they say you have to be disciplined against Utah because they can beat you in that 18 to 24 second type of range. How much of that is by design, that you see opportunity maybe by exploiting the shot clock?
Well, I think my first year here, when I got here, you looked at our team, and like all teams, you know, over a three-year period, your team's different now. But I think philosophically, we still felt like we wanted to defend. And the other part of that, frankly, the pace has been all the rage in the league. I think people, you know, on the surface equate pace with efficiency. And we were trying to run. I mean, that's what I was comfortable with. That's what I had done, you know, previous to being here. And then we looked at, you know, our first year we had Enes Kanter and Rudy Gobert, you know, Derek Favors and Trevor Booker. And that required us to do some different things from a spacing standpoint. And because of that, the offense, you know, took on a different, you know, a different style. And I can remember feeling like we weren't playing good offense. We weren't as good a team. You know, we were really trying to get better. We'd only won 25 games the year before. But we were playing, quote-unquote, slow. And the first reaction I had to that was, gosh, that's, what are we doing wrong? And then you dig a little deeper, and there are a few people that helped me with this, and you're looking at it analytically, and you see, you know, the numbers say that you can be good offensively and not have a high pace. And teams that play fast can really shoot the ball. So they shoot it quick in the shot clock, or they've got a catalyst with the ball that drives the pace. We weren't that. So basically we decided to double down on ball movement and man movement, and that means you get deeper in the shot clock. And sometimes those shots aren't good, but in some ways the analogy that I kind of started to grab onto, maybe it just made me feel better, but there was an NFL analogy where you have a team that has a really good defense and they run the ball and they play a field position game. And so we tried to be a team that played with half-court pace, if that makes any sense. We wanted our guys to see it as like, it's not like we're going to walk the ball up. We're not going to play slow. We need everybody to touch it. We need to move you around, because at that point we really didn't have a dominant offensive player as well. So it made sense for us, for our personnel. And I think that's usually when you see teams and how they play offense, it's usually a function of their personnel. And as coaches learn about personnel, they figure out, hey, this is, you know, this is how we need to play in order to help these guys be as good as they can be. And that's kind of what happened to us as far as trying to make people work and grind a little bit.
When I was flying out here, I was watching Moneyball on the plane, and a scene in it made me think of something to ask you about, which where, you know, Brad Pitt, Billy Beane's character there, he sit at the table after they lost all their guys, and he was talking about guys we can't replace a Jason Giambi. When you went into this kind of off season, did you look at it as we have to find a replacement for Gordon Hayward, or we have to do things fundamentally different to become a different, more successful team?
The latter. You know, I think Gordon was unique. One of the things Gordon was able to do for us is he was the guy at the end of the clock that would make a play. With Rudy and his ability to roll, you know, as teams really drop off and protect the bucket, we were a team that took a lot of mid-range shots because that's what was there. And he was a guy that could make those. So we had to, you know, and George Hill is very different than Ricky Rubio. So you don't abandon a style of play or a system prematurely, but we knew there were going to be different things within how we play that we were going to have to look to. And I think that's, you know, when you lose a great player like that, you know, you have to take a step back, and you're not going to get all the answers until you start playing. And we knew that the evolution, you know, of what we're doing offensively was going to take place over time. We came out this season this year and turned it over like crazy. We haven't done that of late. You know, we're early in the year, obviously, and that needle could swing back on some level, but that was something that was important. We needed to be a low turnover team, and that's hard for us right now because there isn't the connectivity that hopefully will continue to develop. Guys are getting to know each other. We're playing a different way than some guys have played before. Not dramatically different, but there's just different things within an offense that you try to take advantage of. So there was a lot of thought that went into that, and you know, how we wanted to adjust to losing Gordon. And that there isn't an easy answer to that. I think it's something that takes place over time as, you know, as young guys develop. You know, Donovan Mitchell is probably, you know, he and Rodney Hood are our two most aggressive offensive players. But they're different than Gordon as well.
The early conversations that you had with Dennis and with the front office about moving forward and about, you know, just recovering and again, moving forward, probably the right way to put it.
Recovering is a good word.
Recovering too. Yeah. We can go with that.
We did that first. Then we moved forward.
But what were those early meetings like? I mean, was there certainty in how you're going to do it? Was there a lot of back and forth about how you're going to do it?
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, we knew the situation, and there was a kind of not the vision necessarily, but a vision of where we were going and what we were building with the personnel that we'd had. We'd seen that evolve over a period of time. You know, it took a lot of ups and downs to grow as a team. And, you know, really when Dennis and I were talking about it, you know, quickly after, you know, Gordon made his decision to go to Boston, you immediately, and you'd had in your mind that was a possibility previous, but you know, you start talking about it and hashing it out and see where it goes. And I think that's where Dennis's, you know, Dennis's intelligence and his analytical feel, like he's able to look at this and say, hey, we're, this is what we've lost. You know, kind of like what you're talking about with Billy Beane. You know, how do we replace these things, whether it be scoring or rebounding or, you know, post defense? There's so many things that, and how do all these things relate? And so as we're putting a team together, you know, I'm lucky that he includes me in that thought process. You know, I obviously defer to him and have tremendous trust in his ability to build a roster. But, you know, from a coach's standpoint, it's obvious, you know, there isn't a silver bullet with that. There it's a process. And I think the fact that we'd gone through that process before and we're going to go through it a little bit again as we find out about our team, and there isn't, you know, a bunch of moves you can make to all of a sudden, you know, keep you in the same place because your players are different. So from my standpoint, I've got to adapt. We as an organization, you know, adapt. And the good thing about, and not the good thing, the great thing about, you know, the program here is the support we have from ownership and management. I think for a coach to be allowed to take a longer term perspective is really healthy, and I think it fits. You know, it's that's the path that allows you to go through what we went through the last 3 years and to go through that in a different way, but that evolution, you know, when you have support, you're able to think long term.
You have a lot of veterans on this team, good veterans who've been part of this process for the last 4 or 5 years. Coming into camp, did you have any concerns about how they would react to kind of the new reality of where this team was at?
Honestly, no, which is, you'd think you would, you know. The veterans that we've added have been unbelievable. It's, we've been fortunate. You know, my first year, it was Trevor Booker and his energy and his competitiveness. They've all, you know, infuse the team with certain characteristics that fit with, you know, the vision of how, you know, what we want to be as a group. You know, what the identity you want your team to have is always going to be impacted in a major way, you know, by both your best players and veteran players. So, you know, from there, adding last year, you know, Boris Diaw, you know, Joe Johnson, George Hill, those guys, you know, contributed a tremendous amount, all in different ways. You know, Joe still being here. Joe's got such a quiet presence, but such a confidence that I think that was a huge thing for us last year. Boris's unselfishness. Our team, those characteristics and those qualities that we were unselfish before, but I think, you know, Boris demonstrating that, Joe's ability to close games where it gives your team poise late in the game, and we think we've done that again this year, you know, with Tabo, you know, his defensive mindset, his length, his experience, you know, Jonas's energy and just positivism, I think, at a time where our team needs that, you know, and Epke Udo, his experience, and, you know, he's been winning, you know, EuroLeague titles and, you know, has an expectation for winning that we really like. So I think those guys, all in different ways, have been huge for the development of our younger guys. And that's where we are again.
Have you felt that there has been that positive kind of mindset throughout these first four weeks and going back to camp?
Yeah, you know, that's always tempered when you lose. You know, that I think most teams go into the year with an optimism that's natural. Sometimes early success fuels that even more. Sometimes, you know, not playing well or losing can impact that. And it's really my job to maintain that and through whatever ups and downs, whether it be injury or, you know, a bad shooting night or a bad game or a poor defensive effort, that we stay focused. You know, I'm not saying we stay focused the longer term, like too far out, but we stay focused on the growth process and where we want to see our team, and not to derail that process by, you know, a bad game or a bad performance, both for our players and for our team.
You played a team on Friday in Miami that has experienced loss of their own from players over the last few years, pretty significant loss, whether it was LeBron or Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh at the very end. Are they in any way an example for you guys in that, you know, they embraced kind of like to just keep pushing forward. Let's just keep, we're going to try to win every game. We're going to try to do that. And it seems like from the outside, that's what you guys are trying to do. Push forward, win as many games as possible, believing, and this is what Miami's always believed, that winning culture is going to have a bigger payoff at the end than anything else.
Well, they've demonstrated it. You know, I saw Eric this summer, and he actually referenced, you know, that not in that in-depth a way, but just kind of a little bit of encouragement to me that, hey, you know, we've been through this, and, you know, and you'll be fine, you know. And going through that process sometimes isn't easy. But we went through a little bit of that to get to this point. And so it's true, you know, and I think that's one reason that, you know, Miami has so much respect around the league, is that not just that they've won championships, but, you know, the way that they win, how hard they play, those qualities really transcend winning and losing.
This, you know, getting to this point where you were at the end of last year, a lot had to do with player development. You guys are one of the best teams in the league at, you know, taking young guys, not just the blue chip guys, but the guys that are drafted later in the draft, whether it's Rudy or Rodney Hood or now even now Donovan Mitchell, turning them into productive NBA players. Looking at a guy like Mitchell in particular, what do you think you have in him? What do you know about him through 3 or 4 weeks into the year?
Well, I think the biggest thing that is his competitiveness, and you can point to the athleticism and the physicality and the skills and tools, but I think his mindset, you know, that, and then the other part of that, I think, is his desire to improve and the work that when you find out pretty quick, you know, guys that want to put the time in and get better. And when you have a guy that has natural, you know, is talented and feels that way, you know, I think as a coach in an organization, you know, that's where the development, you know, can occur. When a player has the right mindset, the intelligence, the desire, and then the tools. And because I don't, they all, you need them all. You know, Joe Ingles is a good example of a guy that we felt like had, you know, there was something there, and a little bit of a fresh start for him, having been in Europe for a long time. And, you know, working with him and trying to continue to, whether it be him beginning to have more confidence in his shooting, you know, changing how he plays a little bit, learning how to play pick and roll, getting a little bit of a mid-range, kind of some tricks, so to speak, on how to finish. And you mentioned some of the other guys, you know, Rodney's development, you know, has been really, really important. And I think those guys beginning to see themselves, you know, not necessarily beyond what they're capable of, but maybe beyond where they are at a certain point that, you know, you can, coaches and assistants and organizations can, you know, get credit for that, but really the credit goes to the players in their ability to be honest with themselves, you know, say to really say, this is who I am right now, but I can be better, and this is who I want to be a year from now, 2 years from now. And I think one of the biggest things maybe is we sometimes think of development only in terms of younger players, where, you know, I'd like to think that, you know, guys can get better even when they're older. You know, Joe's an example of that at 29, or, you know, you see different players add things to their game, and hopefully the culture, you know, encourages that.
I asked you about the mindset of your guys coming into the season, and if they had, how they felt about the new reality. What about you? How long did it take you to kind of put the past behind you and be comfortable just looking forward?
Yeah. Not that long, to be honest with you. You know, I don't think there was a sense of this incredible, you know, kind of loss, setback. I think that, you know, when your focus needs to go immediately to where you are in the moment and the players that you have. And like I said, they're the ones at that point that deserve your attention and your energy and your effort, because that's where you are. And we've got enough guys like that where, you know, that transition wasn't a hard one for me. You know, I was already excited about Rodney Hood and, you know, where he's been going and how he's been moving. And, you know, that you go there, you know.
I'll never understand what teams missed in Rodney Hood. Like, what is it about a guy that scores a lot in college and, you know, shoots the three well in college and does pretty much everything well at that level? Are we just obsessed with 18-year-olds? Are we?
I don't know. We have to.
You know, I think, to be honest with you, I'm glad I don't have that job. I'm glad Dennis has that job, and he's great at it because we've been able to find some guys like Rodney, like you mentioned. But the draft is so imperfect. You know, I mean, I think for every, you know, high pick that misses, quote unquote, there's, you know, a lower pick that, that makes it. It's it's. I think it's just hard. But, you know, that's why that's such a tough job. And I'm glad I don't have it.
But you were, sorry, I interrupted you there. You were talking about how long it took you to kind of move on. Didn't take you very long at all, you were saying.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to kind of diminish the process, but I think, I mean, when you, you know, I've had enough situations that I've been through or been confronted with that you maybe don't anticipate that, you know, through experience, I think you learn a little bit about resilience and, you know, that there's no time to look back and you move forward and you, and then the other component is it's a challenge, you know, and I think we all, you know, frame the right way. That's something you can really embrace and enjoy. And that was really the enthusiasm, the excitement that I wanted our team to feel going into the year. And it's genuine.
Was it important for you to convey that sort of optimism, that sort of we're moving forward to your players, given that over the first couple of weeks, I would imagine they get asked a lot about the past and what it meant? I mean, was that a...
Yeah, I there's nothing wrong with, you know, that line of questioning makes sense, right? Because it's a reality. But I think the one thing for us is we feel like that we've developed, you know, culture gets thrown around so much, but an identity maybe. And that identity doesn't attach itself to any one player. And so whether that be, hey, you know, defensively, like something that you're literally, you know, is measurable in a finite, you know, short term, or something maybe a little more subtle like development, those things are still there. That's who we are. It's just different people that are doing it. So I think the culture in that sense, you know, foundationally is strong. And that's where you go. You know, you go to, hey, let's be unselfish. Let's be competitive. You know, let's be a team that's connected and communicates. And let's be a team that is capable of persevering, because that you know, the persistence is something that I think we've experienced in, you know, having, you know, over a 3-year period, winning 30 games, winning 40 games, then winning 50 games last year. That growth is something that you can reference. And, you know, wherever we're at this year, I don't think really we know. I don't think anybody knows. It's speculative. There's a lot of teams like that. We're definitely one of them. And we understand that. But I think, again, that those pillars, that foundation is the stuff with which, you know, you focus on and move forward.
Mike D'Antoni has said to me that for his team to be a good team, they've got to be top 15 defensively. Top 10 defensively, they can be a compete for a title. Is the reverse true in any way with the way you guys play defense? I mean, you're a consistent top 5 defensive team. Do you have kind of a number in your mind or a position in your mind where you, if you're out there offensively, you can be an impactful team?
Not yet, you know, because if, you know, where we've been, our struggles offensively on a given night, you know, can make you feel like, gosh, we're going to have to hold teams to 75 points to win. And then there's other nights where you shoot the ball well or whatever the case may be, and, you know, it's easier to score. So I think that for us at this point, because the year's so young, it's really hard to attach a number to it. What we have known is that regardless of where the offense is, the defense is going to be something that's got to be there. We're going to have to be elite defensively in order to win at a consistent level. And that's part of what you can control. It's, you know, every time you don't score and you have to run back and defend, it gets a little harder. And there's a reason that you don't score points on defense. Now, what we've, you know, us coaches have little drills in practice where, you know, the defense scores when you get a stop. They don't actually score the game that way. So there's a lot of, you know, positive reinforcement when you score. Guys hit a shot, they get a little energy. Guy gets a dunk, he gets a little juice, and you usually defend a little better or with more passion in a given moment. But that has to be who we are. To me, what I've told our group is going through that, you know, it can build some resolve. It can build some mental toughness on the defensive end, where you're able to get stops when things aren't going well. And then the other part of it for us is, you know, our defense has to help our offense. We have to be able to convert when we get stops, and that's been a real emphasis. We're not there with that yet, you know, but we're talking about it a lot. We're working on it, trying to figure out, you know, even on a little level tactically, what we can do with spacing and, you know, and movement quicker in the clock to convert off stops.
You talked about pace earlier, and you bring in a point guard, and Ricky Rubio is one of the better pace point guards in the NBA in terms of playing up-tempo. How have you found incorporating his strengths into a team that's not necessarily used to playing that way?
Right. Well, again, I think offense gets driven by personnel, you know, like we said before. The way that I look at pace, because it's been something that we've tried to think a lot about because of whatever your vision is for your team and then the reality of who you are and how you try to maximize that is, you know, everybody pretty much plays at the same pace out of timeout. You know, no one has like a really fast under out of bounds play. They're always, the pace isn't going to vary a whole lot, you know, in a dead ball situation when someone runs the play. You know, there are some plays that maybe are more quick hitters, but those usually come in the flow of the game. After timeouts, side out, dead balls, the differentiator on pace is how quickly you shoot after misses. And we've been a team, because of our personnel, we haven't had, you know, an engine, so to speak. I mean, when you think about, you know, George Karl's Denver teams, it was Ty Lawson that drove that engine. You know, there usually is a singular player or a couple of players that do that. So our focus has been on maximizing, you know, what our efficiency in those different situations. And what that led me to was that we need to play faster after misses. We need to be more willing to shoot quick in those situations if we get an open look. Because we felt like in those, if we do get into a half-court game and we don't have, you know, like a more of a go-to guy, at least at this point, that's until that evolves during that situation, that we need to be more aggressive in the full court to try to generate better looks. Now after makes, it's a little different, and we still feel like the movement, I'm willing to sacrifice. You know, I want to take a quick shot if we have a good shot. But some of that is a player's perception of what a good shot is. You know, I may feel like a contested shot is a good shot. Other guys, if they're contested, they may not take that shot. And so that's the situation where we feel like, you know, let our offense help our defense, make someone work a little more. So they're not, after they just scored, they're not back on offense in 7 seconds, because that game usually in that situation doesn't play to our strengths. But again, you know, in another situation after misses, and we're playing significantly faster, particularly on a percentage basis, just that the league's playing faster. So it doesn't necessarily equate, but I think we're doing what we envision doing. We're not doing it as well as we want to, but that, again, is a process, and we'll keep adapting, you know.
You talked about embracing the challenge of this reality here with this team. And you give credit to the players for player development. That's 100% true. But, you know, a guy like Gordon Hayward and others would be the first to say that you, this staff, the front office, has been instrumental in developing him to the point he was at. I mean, he was the 9th pick coming out of a mid-major when he came to the NBA. Do you take it on in your staff and the front office as almost the challenge to develop the next, you know, kind of all-star player, whether it is Donovan Mitchell or Rodney Hood? I mean, is that an exciting part of any of this to you?
It is. I think Dennis has confidence in the work that we're doing. I feel like we've assembled a staff that it's a tremendous strength. You know, when you look at, you know, what Rudy's done, you see Alex Jensen. When you look at what Gordon's done, you see Johnny Bryant. You know, so there's a lot of pride and work that goes into that with our group. And it's something you're proud of, you know. I mean, in Gordon's case, I think our group as a coaching staff feels good. Feels like in some level you share in some of that success because you're doing your job. And, you know, when Trevor Booker signs with Brooklyn, although we missed him, we're happy for him, you know. And so you see guys that come here that get better.
He was fired up the other night.
He always plays good against us.
A little fired up.
Yeah. He used to talk to me when he came out of games. Now he doesn't have to come out of the game to talk to me. He just can yell at me from the sideline. He's a favorite of mine. He gave us a lot in terms of his energy and his competitiveness and his play, obviously. But that developmental component, really, that's, I think, as far as strategically in building our group, that's where, you know, we can find value. And we know that, and it's something that we try to do. And then part of it, you know, Igor Kokoschkov, who coached Slovenia to the European Championship this year, we've known each other for a long, long time. We worked together in college at Missouri, his first year out, my first year at Missouri. We used to talk about part of development is playing. And, you know, when I was in Austin, I remember, you know, RC and Pop, one of the biggest things was just our team competing. And then, you know, Mo McComb, who's a good friend and a mentor, just reminded me that winning is part of development. So it doesn't happen in a vacuum. You know, I think players, as they get better, they also need to understand part of getting better, part of development is understanding how to make winning plays, whether that be defensively. We think of development oftentimes just in a skill sense. You know, Dante Exum's a great example. You know, a guy that, you know, and it's unfortunate that he's had some tough breaks with an ACL and now with his shoulder. But the experience of playing for him laid a foundation for his improvement. Because when you play, you know, you learn what you need to improve on. And then it kicks in, too, where a player that has mental toughness and desire is able to work on those things. And so it's cyclical in some ways. And that's where young players, where you see, that's why you see young players developing, you know, that people get better between whatever ages, because there's so many new experiences. So to the extent we can, you know, be transparent and here's what you're good at, here's what you're not, and then go work on it and then watch it in film and then apply it in a game and do it again and again and again and again, you know, I think that's the way it's got
to
happen.
Has it been hard to keep Dante's spirits up in the aftermath of a second major injury?
I think there's a lot of people, the answer is yes, but it's almost as if we have to catch ourselves and not feel sorry for ourselves. Dante's the one that's going through this, but it impacts our whole group. He's resilient, you know, and I think he's touched a little bit of it, even though it was only preseason or the end of last year. This summer he really put great work in, where there's a hunger that he's got right now that's through the roof, you know. And not that hasn't always been there, but I think as he's invested and he's undergone, I mean, he's been through a lot. I've been hard on him, and I think in a very fair way. He may not think that all the time, but, you know, he knows how much I respect and appreciate him. And we've coached him not just to be good, but to be great. And sometimes that involves saying tough things. Hopefully you say them respectfully. But Dante's, you know, he's used that to get better. And I have every anticipation that he's going to come back, you know, equal or better. He's had to, you know, when you go through that, you know, you develop a level of fortitude from a mental standpoint. And Dante's always been, I think, an intelligent, high-character guy. But there's a toughness that begins to develop and a determination, you know, when you have to battle back like that. That's why this one was so hard, because he'd gone through that once. And he'd come out of it and he'd attacked it. And now he's got to do it again. But he's determined.
You talk to his father much?
I don't talk to his dad. I talk to him. He talks to his dad. Not
just
the,
just the just. The,
I know you're going with the Carolina thing, right?
The great. I've never before heard a Carolina Australian accent combined. Oh. Like it's unbelievable.
His dad's a terrific person. He's a terrific person, and he's come visit. His family came. Mm-hmm. His mom too. He's got a great family. I think it's been hard for him, frankly. You know, to be on another continent at 19, and then to go through injuries at that point. It's not like you come over and all of a sudden it's going good and you're playing. You know, that's when you have some of that anxiety about not seeing your family. But his family's, they're terrific people, and and really supportive. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been important for him.
Before I let you go, the despite all of the, what happened this offseason, it must have been really hard for you to see Gordon go down in the way he did. I mean, just what was your reaction when it happened?
I mean, there's no animus from us towards Gordon. I mean, if anybody, you know, if that could be perceived when a player and a team kind of split up. But he did it. He really helped us in so many ways. You know, his competitive spirit, his play, obviously. You know, he helped build, you know, us and this iteration of us. And so, but the opportunity for him was one that he wanted, and you respect that, and you want the best for him, you know, under the circumstances. And I think that uniformly throughout the organization, I know the team, I mean, everybody was quick to reach out to him. And, you know, that sometimes, I don't think that seems hollow, but, you know, he's in a place where he's dealing with something that's pretty serious at that moment. And I'm sure he was, so more than anything, I thought it's scary. Mm-hmm. You know, there's fear involved in it. And I think we showed him as much support. He knows that. He knows how I feel about him. And I reached out to him, and I'm not going to bother him, but just wanted him to know that, as I did after, you know, he chose to go to Boston. Mm-hmm. He deserves good things to happen to him, and they will. I have every confidence that the same way that he dove in and as hard as he worked to become a player, that he'll do the same thing with his rehab. He knows how to do that.
Mm-hmm. Gwynn, I know it's a busy weekend. Thanks for taking some time to join me here.
My pleasure. Good to see you. Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Bobby Marks and Quinn Snyder for joining the show. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.
Thank you for downloading this episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
He hasn't really distinguished himself.
Chris is in desperate need of validation.
I think your opinion is shared by everyone.
So please, subscribe, like, comment.
I would punch him. That's just my opinion.
At your earliest convenience in the iTunes store.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.